to do. So let's start here with me and you. Gonna take a little time. Let's see what.
Welcome to Tell Me Your Story, New Paradigms for a New World. I'm Richard Dugan, your host. I really do appreciate your taking time to share this hour with us here on the program as we bring you choices and knowledge of those choices to help make your dreams come true. We stream live at richarddugan.com and newspress.com. We are also archived. That's right. I do the archiving. I go back in the stacks where it's all dusty and cobwebby and shelve these away so that you can listen to them on the internet at richarddugan.com, the radio show page. So I certainly hope that you will go to the metaphorical stacks, the Library of Congress, my Congress, whatever, and check it out. richarddugan.com, the radio show's page. You can also find out on our schedules page what's going on. And we also have some projects going on through a website called Kickstarter. If you'd like to be a part of that developing event, you can see a short little video I created. I'm not really into video, but I know how to work Photoshop, and I'm pretty fairly good at audio. I've been in it about 35 years, so I kind of know what I'm doing. So please check that out. It's a Kickstarter project that we have going, and we're going to have others going on in the near future as well. So go to richarddugan.com and check out the video, and if you can, support the projects that we've put out there. Our project today is one that, and I've wanted to use the phrase, it's near and dear to my heart, this subject, but it's kind of weird to say that when you're talking about transitioning or death and dying. And yet it intrigues me, as I've stated before in previous programs dealing with the subject, to no end. Well, we're going to have with us today on the program an author and an afterlife expert to talk about the subject of death and dying, or as I prefer to use the word transitioning. We'll maybe find out what my psychological hang-ups are there. I don't know. Anyway, fun. We have a couple of books here that she's written. Fun of Staying in Touch. It's from our loved ones. Contact us, how our loved ones contact us and how we can contact them. And also, The Fun of Dying. Find out what really happens next. And Roberta Grimes is my guest. And Roberta, thank you so much for joining us on the program.
Oh, Richard, I'm so glad to be here. This is, you know, I use the term graduation. Death is a graduation. This is just a bad day in school, not even a bad week.
Well, my grade school and high school graduations were not real positive experiences. So I don't know.
Well, actually,
but I like the word. I do like the word.
It's better than transitioning, because who knows what the heck is after that. And we're going home from school eventually. But I use the word death. Mm-hmm. Death has gotten a bad rap. A well-planned, properly handled death is the best time of your life. It's something to look forward to your whole life long. So it's
that
kind
sounds
of bad rap.
A little ironic.
Let's talk about it happily.
Yeah. Well, that sounds a little ironic that death should be the happiest part of your life. A couple of things my father once said to me, he says, enjoy your life. It wasn't quite so much eat, drink, and be merry for today, tomorrow you die. It was more eat, drink, and be merry in moderation, because nobody gets out of this world alive. Yeah. And one of my favorite television series, the Bob Newhart Show, there was an episode where he is ready to step into the elevator and the car isn't there, but the cables are. And he, of course, leaps out into the shaft, grabs the cables, and, basically has this death-like experience that he runs throughout the entire series. Well, he and Emily are in bed one evening, and he is just going on and on about this situation. It's just, Bob, you know, what's the big deal? You know, it's not that big of a deal. It's death is just a part of life. To which he responds, yeah, it's the last part. And it's like,
but you see, that's wrong.
Yeah, there you go. At the last part of life, which is not.
It's actually, your life is eternal. Human minds are eternal by definition. We never began, we never will end. So to say nobody gets out of this world alive is the exact opposite of true. Everybody does. It's easy. Death is easy. Death is fun. death, which is why I use the term the fun of dying. The only people who have complained about the title are people dying of cancer who say, this is not fun. And I say, yeah, but the fun of being dead didn't have the same ring to it. So I had to call it the fun of dying. But this is everything people believe about death. And this includes Christians. This includes all everybody that I've ever talked with. Unless you've done the research or talked to someone who has or read books by them, you have no idea. You have no idea. This information has been hidden from us for the past 100 years by the people we trust the most. It's been literally hidden away, and they've tried everything else to explain the stuff that they're trying to explain. And this includes especially scientists, but also religionists, also Christians. Christian clergymen cling to teachings that are wrong, which is sad because Jesus told us exactly these truths 2,000 years ago. You'd think they'd listen to the guy that supposedly founded their religion, but they really don't.
Well, it's rather interesting to think about in terms of especially one of the passages that comes to mind quite often when talking not just about death and dying, but just about life in general and the melees that we seem to be in and yet that we don't have to be in. And I still remember these words, whether they be accurate or not, I don't know, but the meaning is certainly profound. You know, that he's doing all these miracles and his followers basically say, hey, you know, what's the deal here? This is incredible. You know, how can we learn to do these things? He says, hey, don't worry about it. You know, these things, hey, you'll be able to do these but
these
greater
things and more
works.
You will do.
Exactly.
Absolutely.
Exactly. And I sometimes wonder, well, where are those greater works? Where are those more miraculous and wonderful things? But one of the things that has always perplexed me is the fact that to him, that's just the way he was. This was nothing miraculous to him. This was life. This was normal, if you will, in his life and experience.
But he used the power of the people he helped. He used the power of their minds. We all have these powers in our minds. They're latent there. And he would say to someone, do you believe I can do this? And the person would say, and he would say, you know, according to your faith, will it be done to you? Your mind is going to do it. Yeah. It's your belief that I can do it that's going to make it happen. He said that whenever he did a miracle, you know, cured someone or helped someone that way.
Mm. Well, to me, it's still astounding to me how life not only begins, but also how it is maintained. I mean, it's just like really one instance, and I love this from the Temple Grandin movie, where she watches cattle being slaughtered, you know, and she says, well, where'd he go?
Yeah,
you know, one, he was just there, and now he's gone. And in a manner of speaking, for us, it's the same thing. One moment, the body is animated, and the next minute, next instant, it's no longer animated. It's like, what happened? I don't know if you've ever seen this, and I'm trying to recall the title of the film, but what they were doing, the scientist, this gentleman was dealing with the same kind of subject, and they weighed the physical body before death.
Oh, yeah.
And then they weighed it after death. And
it's like an ounce or something.
Even less than that. But what was? But that was so fascinating. And I thought, wow, they have actually put a tangible aspect to that essence that animates us.
Yes, but in reality, it doesn't have weight. So I
I wonder what they were.
All the things that people wonder about death, we have been getting good information from the dead and now, frankly, from quantum physics as well and consciousness researchers for more than 100 years. If you have questions about where do you go, if you have questions about what happens at death, if you have any of these questions, Richard, I can tell you, and it shouldn't be anything, you shouldn't believe me, I can tell you where to get the information. It's all there.
Mm-hmm.
It's just that we think that the people we trust most, If they don't look at something, then it must not be real. I've heard that so many times. Why aren't scientists working on this? They're not, because science has become a belief system.
Yeah.
And that belief system is mightily challenged by this information, because their belief system is atheism. They used to call it the fundamental dogma. I've seen that in print in older books. They don't use it in print anymore, but that's still how they think.
Mm-hmm.
You can't go anywhere near possibly finding God, because then the religionists win.
Mm-hmm.
But the thing is, they're wrong too.
Yeah.
The things that Christians preach about death are totally wrong.
Well, I had the pleasure of interviewing a physicist some years ago, and he wrote a book book called about the fifth dimension. And he and I were got to know each other fairly well, and we were walking from lunch one afternoon, and he started to describe. He says, "Richard, I can prove the first dimension. I can prove to you that it exists. Okay, I can show you height, and then the second dimension the same, and the third dimension." And then he says, the fourth dimension, I can't prove to you it exists, but I can prove to you its effect on us, which was time. Mm-hmm. He says, then he started to describe the fifth dimension. And his description went on and on and on. And I was understanding what he was saying, in spite of the fact that I'm no physicist myself. And I said, hold on a second. And we stopped. I says, everything that you have just described about the fifth dimension, I can only sum up in one word. And it's the best word I could come up with at the time. I says, you've just described man's general concept of God. And he said, exactly. Right. Now, this was a physicist who came to the same conclusion. So that's kind of where I want to start, because this process has been set in motion, and we're not going to get into a lot of, certainly no debate here in that regard, but certainly questions to you in regards to who or what is the creator of all of this that actually created this process that we call death.
Oh, I can tell you. Based on what the afterlife evidence all taken together tells us, the only thing that is objectively real, that actually exists independently, is an energy-like potentiality without size, without form, infinitely powerful, alive in the same way your mind is alive because your mind is part of it, highly emotional and therefore probably self-aware, the way you are. You're self-aware too. Our minds are part of this energy-like consciousness, which, as I say, is infinitely powerful, but it's not big or small. It has no size. In fact, time doesn't exist either. Neither time nor space objectively exists, just this energy. And that is what we have perceived as God, but it doesn't have a beard, and it's not anything like a human being. Our minds are like it, though. That's the thing. Our minds are part of it. But we forget that when we're here. We also are infinitely powerful and infinitely creative. So what do we create here? We create negativity. That's a choice. We create it because we don't know better. If you want to fix the world, you cannot fix it until you understand what human beings are. Because we think we can fix it by putting people into smaller and smaller boxes, and the opposite is true. If you make people truly free, if you allow them to respond to their true natures, you'll have peace on earth the next day.
There have been a couple of concepts, man-made constructs, that I've been observing really don't exist in that which you have just described. A lot of people are very much, and again, I don't want to take it away from anyone, but I need to kind of set this out there and ask your observations. Individuality, freedom, liberty, even free will. Those constructs, if you will, in the aspect of connecting with that energy that you speak of, where there is no time or space, just is.
Uh-huh.
None of that is real. None of those constructs are real.
Well, say them again, and I'll tell you how they relate.
Well, okay. I need to preface it by saying that intuition. If I'm listening to that still small voice, and I acknowledge that that still small voice is that higher power, that energy source or force, and I'm going to do in the physical body, I'm going to do the things that that still small voice is suggesting or asking me to do, I am no longer, and I stay in that zone, shall we say, I don't need to be concerned about free will or freedom or liberty or privacy or any of those things, because those are irrelevant to the greater or grand design or greater picture, the larger picture of things.
Let's talk about what you really are. Did you see the movie Avatar?
I did.
Okay. This body you think you are in is Jake's blue body.
Yes.
It's in this alien place. You're connected with it, but you're not in it at all. You're connected by mind at a distance.
Mm-hmm.
Your mind is nowhere near this body. You just think you're there. And we can talk about how I know that's true, but I mean, there are many, many proofs of it.
Mm-hmm.
Your mind is in God even now. You have, most of you is not at all connected with this body. You're this, the small awareness that you have while you're connected to the body is the same small awareness Jake would have had, just limited to this little blue body kind of life. You're limited to this little earthling kind of life. But your greater self makes most of your decisions. Scientists call it the subconscious. It's more like a superconscious. That's most of you, maybe 80% of you. And most of the things you do in the course of the day, most of the decisions you make, most of what goes on is not conscious. If you had to stop and think through how to drive a car each time you drove, you'd never be able to do it. The intuition you get is your higher consciousness and your guides. That's a whole other topic, telling you things. And it's good to listen to them because they know a heck of a lot more than you do in the little blue body you inhabit right now. But we tend to think that these bodies are important. They're not. You're in an eternal life. The minute you spend in this lifetime, it means nothing. It's just, as I say, maybe it's a bad afternoon in school. It's not even a whole day. It's a place for you to learn to love and a place for you to learn to forgive. And everything that happens in your life here, in this artificial place that we call the universe, is a lesson in learning either to love or to forgive, or maybe both. So that's where we are. So when it comes to individuality, you are aware of individuality. But as Einstein himself said, that the sense of being separate may be an illusion of consciousness. It mm-hmm. is. It's not an illusion. We are all one being. There is one of us here. One of us. And that's it. We think we're separate, but we're not.
Mm. I can agree with you on that. And that is one it's hard to get over.
I know it is hard. I'm not saying this is easy. It's just true. That's all.
But the especially, for example, if you're in your car driving. I mean, it's like, you know, that,
whoa, yeah, pull over, everyone. Pull over,
yeah,
please.
That knucklehead over there is not a part of what I'm a part of.
Oh,
he
that's
can't
right.
be.
Oh, that kind of thing, yes.
Yeah.
Well, that's where the forgiveness is concerned.
Yes.
We don't know why we're supposed to be learning these lessons.
Yeah.
We're in kindergarten. This process goes through graduate school,
mm-hmm.
and most of it doesn't happen on Earth. So we're just learning these very simple lessons. Don't hit other people over the head with blocks is a very simple lesson,
yeah.
and that's what we're here to learn.
Go ahead.
Well, I was just going to say, driving is, I think, a great opportunity. I think God invented driving so we could learn to love and forgive. Think about it. People cut you off in traffic. Instead of letting it ruin my day, what I taught myself to do is, immediately I think, oh, he's late. He's trying to get to the hospital. His wife is in labor. Oh, I hope he makes it. The baby's not doing well. And I send him love and light to the car and hurry him on his way. Someone drives past me and gives me the finger because I tend to drive slowly when I'm thinking, and that's most of the time. He gives me the finger. Oh, the poor man, he has only one finger. Oh, I hope they find a way to reattach the others. That's what you do. You turn what, and you can't let other people's negativity affect you at all. You've got to turn it into love on your part. And you can do this. Believe me, it works beautifully. And boy, does it elevate your day when you stop thinking of everybody around you as a negative entity. You've got to think of them all as just you. Each of them is a powerful, eternal being. Each of them has the same lessons you have. Each of them is part of you in a more profound way than you can imagine. We are all one family. Think of it that way if you don't want to think of us at all, as all one being. We are one family. Do you know, Richard, everybody who has European ancestry, if you go back 1,000 years, we all have common ancestors, all of us, everybody with European ancestry. If you go back another few hundred years, that includes everybody on Earth, including people not European. How's that?
That's terrific. You know, the thought that came to my mind when you mentioned our existence, I've used the concept of literally a puff of smoke, and that we're here for that brief a time. And
yes.
That the smoke, which is, you know, not too many people think of it in this way. Smoke is made up of very small particles of the ash of that which was burned up. And it look, you know, we call it smoke. It's floating in the air and so forth. And we think it's something other than that. But it is nothing more than tiny little particles. And obviously the proof in that is that when the ash finally, the smoke settles, as they say, what do you have? You have that coating of ash, like on your cars when we've had these wildfires out here in the on the Central Coast. That's what we get. So, but it's very brief a time, and it's that fragile in that sense in terms of this existence. But what you just stated was, doesn't matter whether it's fragile or not. It's not real. This isn't what's really important.
It's not real. That's right. I mean, we tend to think that what's around us is solid, but if you get down tinier and tinier, if you get inside an atom, you find all those, what they used to call particles and still do, I guess that's nostalgia. That's nostalgia for you.
Yeah.
It's all vortices of energy. That's all it is. They've never found a particle that was not just a vortice of energy. And that means that it's all illusion.
Yeah.
I mean, it is in the most profound way all illusion. Now, it's your body is illusion, too. Your body's part of the same stuff. And therefore, you can't put your hand through the wall. Otherwise, you would be able to do it easily. And the dead can do it easily. The dead are exactly where we are. They're in the same exact place we are.
Mm-hmm.
There's no cloud above where they sit. There's nothing below.
About the transitional spaces that we have been taught about in terms of crossing over? You know, you have the disembodied spirits are stuck here, and we need to help them to cross over and go into the light, and all those kinds of things. Is that all another construct that we've created because it's easier to deal with that than, for whatever reason, to deal with the actual truth of the matter?
There are a lot of people who, for one reason or another, get stuck in transition. Now, numerically, not many, but I mean, numerically, a lot. Percentage-wise, not many.
Mm-hmm.
But even one is tragic, and there are a number of ways it can happen. One, as you say, is they don't want to go, and their minds are powerful. They don't have to go, and you can create, once you're out of your body, and if you know what you're doing, you can create an illusory reality. In fact, most religions have an illusory reality to which their adherents go. If they believe strongly enough, that's where they're going to end up.
Mm-hmm.
For example, apparently there's one that's a cloud with St. Peter's gates there, or not, sometimes just the cloud. You could end up there if that's where you believe you're going. There is hell. The only accounts we have of a fiery hell, the only ones, are from near-death experiences where people believe they belong there. And as soon as they go, oh, no, help, I'm in hell, they immediately are out of that illusion. That was pure illusion.
There's a passage going from the Bible that refers, there are two of them actually. One is that it is appointed to a man at once to die. And then the judgment. And we'll set the judgment aside for a moment. It's appointed to every man.
We don't have to. I'm happy to talk about that.
We'll talk about that. But then there's another story in the New Testament, in one of the Gospels, where Jesus raises Lazarus from the dead. Now, either the rule applies to 100% or it doesn't apply to 100%. And then there are those who say, well, but Lazarus really wasn't dead. I mean, it's like, well, wait a minute. Now, either you take the book at face value, I mean, because many people, that's what they do. They take it at face value, or you don't. I'm one of those who doesn't take it at face value. There's something missing. And in spite of the fact that it's still very inspirational, can be certainly a guidance for a lot of folks. There's more there than meets the eye. And I wish I knew how to read Hebrew, because then I would get a version of the Bible in that language. And
you don't want Hebrew. That's not the right language. You want Aramaic.
I beg your pardon. Aramaic. I beg your pardon. Aramaic.
That's okay.
Anyway, because there's so much that's lost in translation. But having said that, let's just say, hey, we get one shot in this lifetime. We die once and it's all over. Then you got to throw in reincarnation into the mix. And there are even examples of that in the Bible, reincarnation is real. So
it is real.
Death, it, as you've already stated rather clearly, death is not really death. It's like, and I love the fact that you like the idea of the driving aspect, because I use the car as a metaphor in terms of dying. And that's like, I'll ask someone who drives, I says, how many different cars have you had?
Yeah.
And they might say 2, 3, 4. Yep. And yet you've still gotten from point A to point B. Yeah. I says, but you've changed vehicles. I says, that's all you're doing. You're just changing vehicles. And if I may use the human construct, over time, you change from one vehicle to the next to continue your education.
Mm-hmm.
The one thing I do love about this particular educational system is the fact that it's really a good one, and no one's been able to improve upon it in that respect.
Oh, yeah. Oh, there are a lot of, and it's far off field, we can talk about it another time.
Sure,
when I hope
sure,
you have me back. But there are a lot of clues that we probably are going through an elevation of the consciousness of the planet, specifically because the kids have gotten too rambunctious and they don't want us to destroy our school.
Yeah.
And that's a topic for another day.
Sure.
But it's potentially very exciting. And I'm watching it happen, Richard, as I talk
to
people in the last 5 years. Mm-hmm. What a huge difference. In everybody's curiosity, interest, and understanding. And people in surveys, especially Americans, are saying that they are not religious anymore, but they're more spiritual.
Yes.
Whoa.
I've seen that
one
too.
That's all the Lord's work. Isn't it wonderful? Wonderful.
It is. It really is. In spite of the fact that being born and raised a Catholic, I still love the ritual. I love the ceremony, the symbolism, and all of those different aspects. There's something about that that really appeals to me, whether that's from interests from past lives, or if there is a part of that essence of me, which is part of the one, if we will, that says, yeah, those elements help to help your human mind to stay connected to me.
Here's the problem. We believe, most of what we believe, and I'm talking about scientists as well, is fundamentally not true. The dead are telling us the truth, and everybody has got to start adjusting to those truths, because otherwise we're all going to be completely confused as things unfold. Mm. Within the next 5 to 10 years, you're going to be able to converse with the dead by phone. It's already been done. It's just not commercially available yet.
Are you telling me there's going to be an app?
There's going to be, I don't know, be an app. Yeah, people are talking about it, actually, as possibly an app. They're not sure. But it's being done. It's being done by computer, and it has been done by phone.
Wow.
And we're just waiting for it to happen. I was telling this to a friend of mine who's absolutely solid in this is all real, and I'm going to die, I blink out. And I was having lunch with him the other day, and I explained this to him. He looked at me blankly. He said, if that happens, it'll be like aliens have landed. I said, I know. We have to get used to these concepts now so it doesn't alarm us, which it will.
Yeah.
Because all our concepts of what reality is are wrong. I do a radio show myself called Seek Reality, and mine is mostly available on podcasts. If you go to Seek Reality on iTunes, it's there for free, and it's a major spiritual podcast. Who knew? It's called Seek Reality because shouldn't we all be doing that now?
Yeah.
Isn't it time to try to figure it all out figure out what's true?
Yeah, I agree with you. And of course, there will be those who will say, well, okay, but which reality? And we can get into that.
There is one reality. That's the problem.
Yeah,
we have
exactly.
a scientific reality, which is just their construct. It's a belief system. And we have a religious reality, which is 2,000-year-old stuff. I mean, in what other area of our lives do we not think through? And I mean, are we still being bled for diseases?
Yeah.
It's crazy to think that God couldn't give us new revelations, which I think is what's happening now. But you know, you mentioned the Bible. If you read the Bible cover to cover, which I have probably a dozen times, you start agreeing with Thomas Jefferson, who said, the words of Jesus stick out in the Bible like diamonds in a dunghill. He was a colorful speaker, was Thomas Jefferson. but he's right. He's right. If you're reading the Bible and you get to the Gospels, suddenly here's a 21st, 22nd century man talking to you in words you can understand.
Mm-hmm.
And this is despite the fact that his words were translated from Aramaic into mm-hmm. Greek and from Greek into English,
mm-hmm.
that they still... You can look at what the afterlife evidence tells us about many things and look at what Jesus said. And he was 95% of what he says in the Gospels absolutely is confirmed by the afterlife evidence. So we couldn't have confirmed his words until the 20th century. So isn't that incredible? Isn't that wonderful?
It truly is. I remember a gentleman that I used to produce for at a religious Christian radio station back in Phoenix. I'm sure that the man has passed away since, because he was rather elderly at the time. His name was Clyde Freeman, and he had a program called Thus Saith the Lord, and he would only have conversations with people if they called in regards to various issues, only using what he referred to as Thus Saith the Lord passages. If Paul said it, Peter said it, John or George or Ringo said it, he wouldn't talk. He wouldn't use those. Even from the Old Testament, if God spoke, he would use those to support his premise. And if somebody could prove him wrong, you know, show him where he was in error, he was more than willing to listen. I loved his slogan, what he shared with me. He says, "My mind is closed to the area that it will remain open to somebody else's perspective, if they can, again, you know, come from that perspective." When we come back, I want to talk about science and death, because one of the things that has perplexed me is this whole aspect of these various levels. Maybe we'll call them evolutionary levels in science, specifically going from physics to quantum physics. I'm thinking, wait a minute, physics wasn't good enough? You have to throw quantum in front of it? Why can't it all be under the same umbrella? Well, maybe we'll talk a little bit about that, but also in terms of how that aspect of science and investigation can help to not only support but prove and have that evidence that tells us that, hey, we are not only not alone, we are all part of the same construct or energy, if you will, and how we can stay in connection with that. I'm Richard Duggan. This is Tell Me Your Story, New Paradigms for a New World. We'll be back in just a moment. Welcome back to Tell Me Your Story, New Paradigms for a New World. I'm Richard Duggan, your host, and we are talking with Roberta Grimes, and we're talking about the aspects of death and dying and the afterlife, if you will. We're going to get into that. We're going to talk a little more about science. The books are entitled The Fun of Dying, Find Out What Really Happens Next, and then The Fun of Staying in Touch, How Our Loved Ones Contact Us and How We Can Contact Them. Matter of fact, I'm actually going to start there. I want to ask you in terms of just real quickly, in terms of dreams, I remember, and it was years after my grandmother had passed, that I had this incredible dream where and please understand that I didn't start driving until I was 38 years of age, and I had this dream prior to that age. And at that time, my parents actually owned a white Dodge Caravan. So in my dream, I am driving on a pristine white concrete highway with forests on one side, and I'm driving in a white van. And so two things obviously are happening that weren't happening in my reality at the time. Suddenly, I turn off into the forest. I come in upon this giant meadow. I'm seeing this as I'm describing it to you, by the way. And it's like my movie is playing as we're doing this. And I come across this beautiful stone house, not like the one that she lived in when I knew her. And I go inside, and there she is. Not a word was said. We gave a hug, and I saw a glint in her eye, just basically telling me, everything's okay. It's all good. Everything is good. And that was pretty much the essence of the dream. But it was those other parts that rather have stuck with me over the years, because my parents gave me that Dodge Caravan for a period of time until I turned it over to my sister. And I'm driving now. Like, really? I hadn't planned on that. So I'm curious as to the communication that those who have died, who have passed on, the communication that they have with us, how is that more frequent than conscious communication with us?
What you described, Richard, was a classic communication dream. Very vivid in your mind. When did this happen? It happened many years ago, right?
It's going to have to be at least 20.
Okay. And it's still vivid, like it could have happened last night.
Oh, I'm watching the movie in my head as I'm describing it to you.
That's the first characteristic of a communication dream, because dreams usually fade by lunch, even if they're vivid. The second is, she looks young, happy, healthy, and in a different place. Sometimes rarely it looks familiar, but usually it doesn't. And the third thing that makes it clearly a communication dream is she doesn't speak. They usually don't speak. Sometimes they do, but it's rare. And it's meant to communicate a very sort of simple, happy, she was communicating things to you that you couldn't have known at the time. This business of you driving was very interesting, because in reality, where she is, there is no objective time. So to her, you were all, if you ever were going to drive, you were already driving.
Hmm.
And that's, it was part of the vision that she gave you. But that this is the kind of communication, one of the kinds of communication I describe in The Fun of Staying in Touch. There are dreams of dead people that are not communication dreams, and you can tell the difference. I've only had two in my whole life, so they're not hugely common, but they're exciting, aren't they? And it's wonderful that it stays there forever.
It's one of the very few that has actually done that. It's just stayed. It stayed vibrant.
Yes.
The colors are still just as fresh as they were the night that I had that dream. And for a long time, I didn't share it with a lot of folks. And it really, it's the only dream I have had that I can recall of someone who I was very close to who passed on.
When we are asleep, most, if not all, every night, we leave our bodies. It's R&R time. We leave our bodies. We might stay in the room. We might travel to a halfway place to the afterlife. We visit with our dead loved ones. We visit with our guides. We play. It's very restrictive for enormously powerful, enormously intelligent, creative beings as we are. You're a powerful eternal being. Don't ever forget it. It's very hard for us to stay stuck in this limited body with a limited brain. And so it's good to be free. If we don't sleep, we die. I think the reason is that we just lose the ability, we just lose this contact with eternity, and it screws up, and we can't support our bodies anymore. But people who remember their dreams will sometimes remember actually visiting with their loved ones and so on. More common, it shows up like a dream like yours. But the regular dreams we have are garbage, right? Most of the time.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I usually don't remember them, but if I remember them, it's like, oh, that could never happen, or it was stupid. Our material brains have, because they're so limited and because their repertoire of memories is so limited, they have a lot of trouble making sense of having been to the end of the universe and back, which is what we can do when we're out of our bodies. But as we get into our bodies again, they're trying to make sense of this. What happened? What are these memories? And so they turn them into garbage, and that's what we remember as a dream.
Hmm. Let's talk about the whole science in regarding this. It was only, I'm going to say, a few years ago, but it was a little longer than just a few, that metaphysics was starting to be taught in college. And prior to that, you would never even bring up the word because it was inappropriate. That wasn't education. That was fantasy land. And yet, my understanding just of the basic definition of the word, most all religions are metaphysical because they're beyond the physical. Most of their teachings have to do with beyond the physical. What we're talking about is very metaphysical and spiritual and so forth.
I think of it as physical. I mean, to the extent that quantum physics is a real science,
mm-hmm.
every bit to that extent, the study of what the dead are telling us should be a real science, because it's the third great physics. We have Newtonian physics, which lasted until the 20th century. You know, at the end of the 19th century, I've got to get this quote and figure out who said it. A very famous physicist at the end of the 19th century said, everything that's to be discovered in physics has been discovered. All that's left is finer and finer measurements. And a few years later, Max Planck, who was one of my great heroes, was expounding quantum physics, which is a whole new world for physicists. And Max Planck got the 1918 Nobel Prize for quantum physics. He should have gotten it for the greatest discovery in all of human history. And that he expounded and they ignored. He said, what we think of as human consciousness is primary and pre-existing. Primary and pre-existing. Here's a quote from him. In 1944, he remembered 1918, he got the prize, so he's been ruminating about this all his life and trying to convince his fellows that they're missing something big. As a man who has devoted his whole life to the most clear-headed science, to the study of matter, I can tell you as a result of my research about atoms this much. There is no matter as such. All matter originates and exists only by virtue of a force which brings the particles of an atom to vibration and holds this most minute solar system of the atom together. We must assume behind this force the existence of a conscious and intelligent mind. This mind is the matrix of all matter. He was right.
Wow.
That's what we live in now. What was the Big Bang? It makes no sense if you think of the Big Bang as something the size of a pencil dot expanded to be this whole universe, right? I mean, you and I know that's crazy, even though that's what they tell us happened.
Mm-hmm.
No, it was the start of a thought. Something akin to a thought in an unconscious internal mind brought forth the universe and holds it in suspension. If any of the cosmological constants were even a tiny bit different, if any of the laws that we think of as the laws that allow life to come forth, if they were a tiny bit different, either the universe wouldn't exist, it would immediately have collapsed on itself, or life couldn't exist. Everything is perfect. Perfect. There are books written about this, mm-hmm. about how close the tolerances are for having life and for having you even able to be able to observe the universe. And so what do physicists do? Do they say, oh, there's something big here. We better listen to old Max? No. What they say is, we bet that a trillion universes came into being at the same time or at some time. And out of them all, by chance, it has to be by chance, because, of course, there's no pre-existing mind at all. By chance, this one happens to work. That's crazy. Anybody with a rational mind knows, well, they know. They talk about Occam's razor, which simply put is that the simplest explanation generally is the best. You don't have to look for what's complicated.
Mm-hmm.
And all the explanations that we learn about the third physics, which will have to be, frankly, will be coming into existence in this century. And it's tragic, tragic. Richard, the people who are now exploring the third wave of physics, none of them are physicists. I mean, I'm a lawyer, for heaven's sake. I shouldn't be in this position. Real physicists, and I hope a young physicist is listening. Read Thomas Campbell's My Big Toe. Go read it. Okay, I think it came out in 2007. When I heard him talk, I was sitting in the audience, and there was all young physicists in the room, and I heard him talk, and he was expounding exactly the same theory that I had come to independently about what reality is. And, you know, that he came at it from physics. I came at it from what the dead tell us and looking at what quantum physics has to tell us, which, by the way, I think is a plug between this level of reality and what's most of reality, where the dead are. But a lot of other stuff happens except just the dead being there. I mean, they aren't sitting around. They're doing a lot of things that that we can't even imagine, frankly. But think about that, Richard. Think how backward everything is in science. When Max, my dear friend Max, in the early part of the 20th century, he started saying, wait a minute, folks, there's something big here. Reality is consciousness-based, and it's human consciousness-based. They discovered that because of the way some of the quantum physics experiments work. But he came to really see that it was true. And this is what the dead tell us, too. Mm. Doesn't this boggle you when you think about it? How can physics be this stupid? I read Scientific American. I love that magazine. There are several of them I read, the popular science magazines, because they all talk about some big thing that's going wrong. And in most cases, I can see, based on what I know, what it is they're missing and fill in the blank. And as I say, I never even took physics in high school. I blog about this at robertagrimes.com. Anybody who wants to watch a lawyer try to do physics is welcome to come read my blog at robertagrimes.com. But it's tragic that I should be doing this. I want real physicists to take it over, because whoever really comes up with a consciousness theory of everything, and that's the only theory of everything that will ever work, that person will get the Nobel Prize. Mm. And that person is probably now a young physicist who's being told, don't study that stuff, because if you do, you'll never have a career. Well, somebody with courage is going to say, wait a minute, doing the same thing over and over again is the definition of insanity, mm-hmm, and that's what mm-hmm. we've been doing for 100 years.
Yeah. All of this is just, on the one hand, it's mind-boggling. For me, and growing up and reading the Bible a number of times myself, much of it just didn't, logically, it didn't make sense. What
no,
I was
doesn't.
Being told, It was so illogical. I met a professor who teaches critical thinking, who he and I have had interesting conversations about this and other subjects. I've had him on my program as well. And it intrigues me, the conversations that we have about these subjects, because on the one hand, the individualistic aspects of this existence warrant that we be kind and gentle and treat each other with respect and all of these aspects, which, you know, even in the other element of the eternal, is still a good thing to do, as opposed to in this reality, you know, being mean and nasty and all of those other things that we read about in the newspapers and see on the news and the and so forth. But logic just seems to me to be so devoid from so many people's thinking. One of the things that I loved in my interview with Greg Braden, when I talked with him about his book, Spontaneous Healing of Belief, his wish and desire is that belief becomes knowing. Not that you take a belief and say, oh, I know it's true because I believe it with all my heart. No. It's when what you have done, Roberta, through your research and investigation, to show the proofs within the accepted realms, they being science, that this is true. It's no longer, well, I believe that after when my body stops functioning, I'm going to do this and go there and have that. Oh, I don't have to believe it anymore. I can know it.
And Thank you, Richard. That's exactly what I'm trying to do. Thank you for knowing that. Thank you.
And I take another word from a book, which believe it or not, I have been reading for probably 20 plus years, maybe even 30 plus years, only because it's taking me that long just to kind of work my way through it. Stranger in a Strange Land. And the word grok, or to grok, is not just to know. It is to assimilate that information, if you will, into every cell and molecule and atom of your being. It becomes part of you. That's what I think Greg is talking about. That's what you're talking about. That's what we're talking about.
That's what Jesus talked about too, didn't he?
Exactly.
Jesus said the same thing. Yes. Yeah.
And so it fascinates me when we start talking about these things. And of course, we are somewhat limited by what we can use, only because the rest of the world either isn't ready and or willing to look at, let alone embrace, some of these ideas, because they're so afraid of losing what little control they think they have over their lives.
Oh, no, this is how you gain control. Right now, either your church controls you, or, you know, the media controls you. You're being controlled because you don't have that lodestone, that touchstone of truth. When you understand that you are a powerful, eternal being, you're here just to learn to love and forgive, and this is not your home. When you really get that to your core, you are free like you've never been free before. I know other people who have also been on this journey, and I can tell you that's a universal truth. It makes you nicer. I was not nice before, Richard, believe me. Makes you nicer and kinder. And it also makes you so much happier because you're free of fear. When you're free, fear of death is the base fear. When you don't fear death anymore, you do not fear anything. You don't fear what was going to happen to the mortgage. You don't fear getting sick either. One of the things that it's very important that people understand is I'm not trying to get you to believe what I believe. I'm trying not to believe anything except what I know to be true. Mm-hmm. I'm trying to be a scientist about this because these are truths. This is a real new science. We don't have to believe stuff. Mm-hmm. So I'm a skeptic by nature. Every time I see something new that relates to the afterlife, I'm very skeptical about it until I have really investigated it myself and seen how it fits. Because there is a major, huge, gigantic truth beyond anything you can imagine. And we found little pieces of it. And they fit. And if something doesn't fit, I assume it's not true.
Mm-hmm.
So I in the back of both of my books, there are lists of about 70 other books, including Greg Braden's wonderful work, including Lynn McTaggart, who's another person who does this work. All these books are there so that if you have the time and you want to read them, you'll be right where I am. You don't have to spend what I've spent decades talking to the, listening to the dead and saying, please, somebody 100 years ago, please, somebody have asked him that question. Because I one of the fun things about reading this old stuff is these people died a long time ago, and their loved ones in the room who were trying to talk to them didn't ask them the questions that I had.
Yeah.
One of the last things I was sure about is that the afterlife levels, levels 3 through 5, are solid. But
okay.
Then finally someone asked that question.
Now, that's another area. Talk to us a little bit about this aspect of these levels of death, of the afterlife. And are these what we have come to understand as are these multiple dimensions in the universe that exist, or is this something totally different?
They exist exactly where we are. If you think of the fact that you are sitting in a room right now where there are hundreds of TV channels, you just don't have a television on.
Mm-hmm.
You turn on that TV, and your mind is the television. Your mind right now is tuned to this level of reality, which we think is the lowest, but we're not sure. Lowest frequency, because mm-hmm. remember, it's all energy. So
right.
The lowest energy frequency, you're tuned to that body on this level. That's why you think you're in that body. But your TV set, your mind is far away. So you're tuned in and you die. So okay, your body, that energy level where you're tuned in now, you no longer have a vehicle to be there. You just tune to a slightly higher level. You're at channel 1, you go to channel 3 or 4, and you pick up a whole new solid reality just as easy as that. And you're in a beautiful young body. And everything is wonderful, but it's as solid as where we are now, and it's in the same exact place. It's just the same way that your television could pick up different signals, but in the same place, because everything is energy. Nothing is solid, so it's easy.
So in one sense, we could say that we are at one phasic level here, whereas when we go into the first or the second or the third, each one is a different phase. And so again, we're able to tap into those different frequencies and again, as your analogy, watch various programs or what have you.
Yes,
is that,
be
is
part
that,
of.
Be part of.
Yep.
I find it really interesting. Talk to us a little bit more about these 5 levels.
Well, there actually are 6 levels, and then there's the source level. And if you add the universe, there are 8 levels. The lowest level post-death is what Jesus called the outer darkness. It's not hot. It's cold, dank, smelly, and disgusting. I say in The Fun of Dying, it's like midnight on a garbage dump with ravening dogs around you who actually are people. It's disgusting. You don't want to be there. The one above it is sort of a purgatory-ish kind of level, but it's at least you can live somewhat normally there. You're getting better. You're learning to forgive yourself. Levels 3 through 5 are what the Vikings called the Summerland. And I call them the Summerland because I don't want to call them heaven, because that's a religious term. But they're beautiful. They're beautiful. They're earth solid. They have colors we don't see on earth. Flowers, nothing dies. And so there are all these beautiful permanent flowers around you in colors you cannot even imagine now. And they give off glorious, not just a glorious scent, but they give off music and they give off energy. Just breathing in a garden is all the nourishment that life, that body you have there needs, because you don't need to eat. You don't even have eternal organs. But the level 6 is to get, most of us, I think, enter at level 3. That seems to be where everybody can, if you've lived a reasonable life, can manage to get. You have to work to get to level 4 or level 5, although some people will go right from here to level 4 or level 5. Level 6 is what has sometimes been called the causal level. It's where apparently a lot of things are created. It's also called the teaching level. In fact, I know someone who lives there, and he calls it the teaching level. There's not much material there, although they can make it pretty if they want to, but they no longer need the illusion there of materiality. And they spend a lot of their energy trying to teach those on the lower levels to rise.
Mm-hmm.
My friend Mikey, who lives there, who died from this world at the age of 20, 7 years ago, he deliberately chose, even though he's a very advanced being, and I mean, remember, I just told you I'm skeptical of everything.
Mm-hmm.
I don't believe any of this.
Right.
Well, Mikey's the real deal. I'm helping him write a book. He came specifically to teach us this stuff. So he came from the teaching level of the afterlife to do that. But anyway, those seven levels, including this level, are all that we really know about. The top level, the highest in terms of energy, although still in the same place, is the source level, mind. It's mind is all of it, and yet it has a focus, because to get close to the center of mind, it's so immensely powerful. We've got to be really, really advanced beings to do that. I don't think anybody has ever come back into the lower levels who has been there, except maybe Jesus, but I'm not sure. We don't know that much about it, and I haven't focused on it because it doesn't matter to most of us. All that the dead will tell us, number one, that there's no atheism at all in the afterlife. They all know what's going on then. And some of the atheists who communicated 100 years ago, the stuff I read, were very cranky to have lost that particular bet. But there are no atheists. But they say that's where God is. The source is God. That's how they thought of it 100 years ago. And they're not in a hurry to get there because they're having fun now. And there is no time anyway. So they're just... they know sooner or later, and it doesn't have to ever happen because, in a sense, it's happening now. They're with God. It's hard for us to get used to the idea that there is no such thing as time, but there isn't in the afterlife levels any such thing as time. And in fact, the dead tell us, the more advanced ones who talk about it, that yes, there is a reincarnation, but you on the earth can't understand it because it's all happening at the same time. And there's evidence of that. In fact, some of the evidence is in the books that I cite in The Fun of Dying. So have I boggled you yet, Richard?
No, not yet. I just find this just, again, all just incredibly fascinating because it opens up some doorways to conversation. And I'm curious as to how you communicate with the dead. What is your process?
My process?
Yes.
I'm totally not psychic. In fact, I resist being psychic. I know I have five clergymen who are my guides, and they have more trouble than most people getting through to their subject. They know they've picked a weak vessel, but they're stuck with me. But I don't communicate with the dead any better than you do. But what I am is a student, and I study what other people do to communicate with the dead. In The Fun of Staying in Touch, a lot of those things that happened, because the dead know I'm skeptical. They made things happen over the last few years, primarily around my mother's death, so I'd be able to tell you about them. But I'm not psychic, and I couldn't call them up at will if I tried.
So
you're saying no. So how do you communicate with Mikey then?
Well, yeah, I know that my grandmother was a dream.
Uh-huh.
So how is Mikey communicating with you?
Mikey communicates through his mother, who knows none of this stuff, and frankly, a lot of the times when he says something, she'll apologize. She thinks it's incredible. But I've watched him answer hundreds of questions, very complicated questions about the afterlife and about reality and about God and about Jesus and about all this stuff. He's never made a mistake. In the last, I've known him for, 2.5 years now? He's never made a mistake. So I know he's real, and he's taught me things. He'll give a long answer to somebody's question, and then he'll say something that is on the edge of what I know, and I'll think, I bet he's right about that. I just learned something new. His mother communicates with him in a way that I thought was impossible, and that's with a pendulum. And I didn't believe for a minute that any of this was possible. But the proof is in what he tells her. He tells her all this stuff that's true and real. I would stake my life on his being genuine.
So can we do the same thing? Can we? I've asked a number of mediums this question about a dear friend of mine who passed. Back in 2003, the three of us, my wife and I and he, were very close, and he died in our home back in Phoenix. And yet the circumstances under which he passed were so questionable, especially his past in particular, led us to believe that he really didn't die. They set all this up so that he would go into the witness protection program. I kid you. No, I'm serious. I kid you not. It sounds funny. It sounds crazy. It sounds like I should be writing a book about this.
Yeah.
And yet I've talked with a number of mediums. Oh, no, he's on the other side. He says, you guys are doing great. And da 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 da. And of course, we keep expecting him to show up at our doorstep one day here in Santa Barbara. And wow, wouldn't that be wonderful?
Yes.
But if I wanted to communicate with him, or is this a one-way conversation, if you will, a one-way communication?
Here's the thing. It's very hard for the direct communication to take place now. We've got to get the soul phone, and people are working on it, and I'm excited about it. But it's could be now, could be the next half of this century. We aren't sure exactly when we'll have one we could go show the world. But right now, right after people die is the magic time. They're trying to send you back postcards. And the postcards that they're sending you are things you are not familiar with. Because for thousands of years, the dead could easily lower their vibration and be right with us, but we can't go higher. So they've been watching us grieve and unable to do anything about it. So since their minds are so powerful that they can manipulate matter, they've learned over the millennia how to do that. And they teach the newly dead how to do that. That's why I wrote The Fun of Staying in Touch. The first half of it is just details about what to look for when someone has just died and what to look for a bit later. What I would do if I had a friend who had died years ago and I really, really wanted something, I would say a lot, and you always should talk to the dead aloud. We can talk in our minds, but there's a positive energy that comes from your speaking aloud. I would every day speak aloud his name, and I would say, I would love to have a sign from you. Read my book, because then you'll know what to look for, because that's how it starts. But some of the signs they give us are incredibly wonderful. Some of them are very subtle. A lot of them we can't kind of believe until, example, my brother-in-law, Jerry, is a very powerful being. He's done wonderful signs. My sister, though, had never read The Fun of Staying in Touch until a few weeks ago. And a couple of days later, she said to me, you know, if I hadn't read your book, I wouldn't have even told you about this. But I was standing in a store, and I was looking at a rack of various things. And you know those racks where there's a hook on the end so it can't fall off? While she was watching it, a lighter on a card lifted up from its hook and sailed and fell onto the ground. That's Jerry. He was a smoker. She said, I wouldn't have even realized that was a sign until I read your book. That's the kind of thing they do.
That's just crazy. That's just crazy talk.
I'm sorry, but they can. The dead can manipulate matter. The dead can do a lot of things. Mikey was one of my sources for The Fun of Staying in Touch. And some of the things that they do are so unbelievable, I had to actually quote him word for word. This is what they do, and this is how they do it. Because otherwise, why believe me? Believe someone who's actually there and can tell you. And he's still giving signs to his family 7 years later every single day because they know what all the signs are. And yes, he communicates through his mother, but he likes to send them hugs. Some of the things he does are wonderful.
Tell me about
they're in the book.
Tell me about some of the television programs that have come out over the years. The one that always comes to my mind is The Ghost Whisperer, and she's just constantly helping people to transition or die or pass on or move on to the next level and so forth. And yet they've got business that they have they need to finish. Does that actually happen to us if there are certain things that we felt like we needed to, that we didn't accomplish or we didn't get closure on and so forth, that we hang around until we can do that?
Yeah, but it's rare. Most of us, virtually all of us plan two or three exit points into our lives that our higher consciousness can take when we've done about all we can do with this lifetime's lessons. Usually one is young, one is medium, and one is old. Mikey tells us 20 was his last one. He was having too much fun. He didn't want to leave. But it's rare, but you could conceivably die in a true accident. And if you do, you won't go through the process. You won't have your deathbed visitors right there because there's no deathbed. Mm-hmm. And you may see people come to get you because as soon as they're aware that you've died, they will immediately come and try to get you. You may not want to go with them because you've got young children because you, as you say, you were in the middle of doing something. And that's the last thought you had in the body. You want to finish it. That's really, really rare, but it can happen. And most more common is people who, for whatever reason, usually they get distracted at the wrong moment because part of the death process, which we really didn't talk about, and there isn't time to talk about it now, but part of the death process is having people around us we know and love, and we go off with them once we're free of our body and the silver cord is broken. But if we're young or if it was an unexpected death or something, there could be panic in the room. She's dead. He's dead. What do we do? Oh, this is terrible. And you want to reassure them, hey, look, guys, I'm swell. Look at me. I'm fine. But they can't see you. And because they can't see you, if you try to get their attention, you will not be able to do it. And you will stop paying attention to the people who came for you and lose your ability to see them. You become stuck, and you're stuck outside of time. You have no idea time is passing. People will talk about the fact they've got a ghost in their house, house built in the 16 or 1700s. I'm from the Northeast. Their houses are like that.
Mm-hmm.
But we see her. She's in the where it used to be the kitchen. She walks through the wall. Well, in her mind, it's the same day she died 300 years ago, and she's walking through what was a doorway at that time. This is pathetic, but it does happen. Mm-hmm. So one of the things I tell people, when you are out of your body, go with the people that came for you. Once you transition, you can, in fact, help your loved ones and give them signs and communicate with them. And once we get once enough people know what the signs are, it's going to be much easier for the dead to communicate with us. But until you get there, you're going to get stuck if you don't go with the people who came for you.
Right. So this question came up from someone not too long ago, and I was talking about death and dying, and the comment was made that I bet you, statistically speaking, that more people die in the process of some trauma, dramatic event, accident, et cetera, as opposed to, say, dying in their sleep or peacefully in a hospital bed, you know, and so forth, and saying, okay, I'm ready now, and away they go. What can you tell me about that particular aspect, because that, I think, probably generates quite a bit of angst and even fear in people in terms of the way that they will die as opposed to just the process.
Okay, well, that's easy. Number one, nearly all accidental deaths are actually planned deaths. Mikey died in a rollover accident. He was the only one who was even injured. The others walked away and he was killed. That was a planned exit. We don't plan suicide, by the way, but virtually all other kinds of violent exits are planned. And we are told repeatedly by those who have died that way that they were out of their body at the time of the death. If you're going to die in an accident, under torture, in some bad way, and it's going to be terminal, you're out of the body when all that happens. The body suffers, but you do not. That's what they tell us over and over again.
And believe it or not, that's actually what I thought. My feeling was that they, prior to the instant, they depart. And I will also share this experience. My first wife was totally blind and had a guide dog, a black Labrador named Yora. And we were taking a walk one Saturday morning, and out of around the corner from one house came two pit bulls. And one of them latched onto her neck and the other one onto her shoulder. And of course, I got down on my hands and knees and I started trying to beat these dogs off and everything. Now, what I noticed about Yora was that she didn't make a sound. Now, she lived through the process. As a matter of fact, couldn't believe it. The next day, she was like, it had never happened. But what I became aware of was that if that had been her time to depart, to die, she had vacated the body so as not to experience that pain. She didn't make a sound, didn't try to fight off these dogs. She just sat down.
Yeah.
Which I wonder if our essence kind of does the same thing prior to those kinds of events. It just not going to do that. Not going to go there.
Yeah, we don't understand how much we're loved. The most profound possible love for each one of us, as if each one of us were God's best beloved child. Jesus says this stuff. They don't listen to him, but it's true. and we are not meant to suffer in any way. We're here to learn.
Mm-hmm.
You know, nobody likes to go to school. We're here in school, but what we're here to learn is so important. It's so basic to what our minds need in order to grow spiritually that we do it. We gladly enter these bodies. And if you think you didn't plan your life, think again. You did. Even that awful ex-husband, you planned it. And so did he. And you both grew from it.
Mm-hmm.
We're loved. We're not supposed to. If we're going to die anyway, they're not going to let us go through suffering. People who have died in auto accidents over and over again, they tell us they saw it from the air. They were above it when it happened. And they were really surprised. There was their body. It was all mushed up. And here they were just fine. And that was almost certainly, by the way, planned that they would go that way. That was what they chose. If I'm going to go at this age, which is one of my exit points, make it easy. Make it a, think about it. Think how easy that is.
Yeah.
You get up that morning and you were perfectly healthy, and you know, by the evening, you had been out of your body for a while and you were with your loved ones in the next level. How could that be easier?
Yeah.
I'd much rather have that than a lingering death. But those who have been through lingering deaths tell us that they planned that too. And they planned it because they learned, they really grew from that.
Mm. So what does this knowledge do for those who are left behind?
I think it helps immeasurably, at least in my case, certainly it has, and in everybody else's case that I know. When you are certain about this stuff, mm-hmm. you know that no matter who the person is who's died, no matter how close you are, you know that their minds are just fine. And you go about trying to communicate with them just as you are with your friend. The earlier you do that, by the way, after a death, the more likely it is that they'll be right easily able to communicate with you because they're probably hanging around you anyway. 10 years later, you can go back and do it. My brother-in-law, Jerry, is still giving us signs 10 years later, but that's unusual. Most of them have moved on and they're having too much fun to bother with us. To them, it'll feel like a minute before we get there. So why would they even worry about us? But it changes everything. My mother died 2 years ago. There was a time in my life when I would have thought that would be my death too. I was happy for her. Yay, Mom! I'm so glad you finally got to go at the age of 93. I told her I envied her that she got to go, and she thought I was crazy because she was afraid of death till the day she died.
I interviewed a woman many years ago who shared a story with me about a 94-year-old woman who she was taking care of, who is very vibrant and alive and everything. And one day she came to her, she says, I'm done. Now, this woman was not depressed. She wasn't terminally ill. She just came to the point, she says, I've done everything I want to do here. I want to go. And this woman was there when she went. And I thought, wow. We do that when we buy, you know, when the old car is just too old to run, we go buy a new one. When our animals are in a state where they're suffering in that case, we do the humane thing. It's kind of weird to say it in that context. We do the humane thing and we let them go. But when someone here says, hey, I'm finished. There's nothing more for me to do here, or in this context, I have completed my coursework. I want to go. You said that you mentioned suicide, but why isn't that part of the planned exit strategy for an individual?
I don't know. I just know that we are told over and over again it was never planned. Suicides are not planned.
Would you consider this 94-year-old woman's act?
No.
Suicide?
Here's the thing. This is what I think I know about suicide, and I just by, because it's one of the things I've been interested in understanding. People who, suicide's never a planned exit point, but people who are either terminally ill or very old or very young, under the age of mid-20s, don't have any issues. They kill themselves and they don't bother. You have to understand where the problem comes from with death. All those people in that lowest level, what Jesus called the outer darkness, mm-hmm. every one of them put himself there. There is no outside judge at all. There's no religious figure. There's no counsel. There's no judge. God doesn't judge you, period. I have never seen any evidence that he does, and neither has any other afterlife researcher. And if you look closely and actually read the Gospels, you find out Jesus tells us the same thing.
Mm-hmm.
So, but there is definitely a judgment. We judge ourselves, and we get to see our lives, live our lives over again in some way I don't understand. And we get to feel this time how we affected everybody else. And there are times, there are things we have done in our lives which we're going to have to forgive ourselves for. And when we get to feel how we made other people feel, we may have trouble forgiving ourselves. But if you don't forgive yourself, your vibratory rate slows. You can no longer stay in level 3. Mm. Then you no longer are able to stay in level 2 because we can't go above our vibratory rate, right? We can only go below it if we want to.
Mm-hmm.
So you end up in the outer darkness. Everybody there put himself there because he couldn't forgive himself.
Now,
So let me just finish. Young and the very old and the dying anyway all forgive themselves. But somebody who's in his 40s, who had planned carefully some calamities that he was sure he'd be able to handle and learn and grow from. His wife left him. He had a sick child. And at the same time, his business partner cheated him. And some other thing happened. He couldn't deal with it. He killed himself. When he gets to the other side, he goes, "What did I do? I flunked. And I feel terrible for doing it." So if you can't forgive yourself for that, you have trouble. So some of the people in the outer darkness level kill themselves, and they may not even have done very bad things. But the act of not completing the lesson you set yourself seems to be very hard for some people at midlife to forgive.
Do they stay there for quite an extended period of time, or is there a fair amount of turnover? They eventually do get to the point where they forgive themselves and then can raise to the next level and so forth.
What seems to be the case, and again, I have to preface all of this with, this is what the evidence suggests. Mm-hmm. What the evidence suggests is you can't get out on your own. You can't raise your own vibration on your own. But there's a lot of rescue work that's being done of earthbounds, of people who got themselves into a hollow heaven because they believed they would always see a church with a steeple, of people in the outer darkness. It seems to be something that very pure, you know, sort of more high-level people, right after they transition, a more advanced being will take them by the hand and say, "Let's go see if we can get some people's attention," and take them into the outer darkness. As long as you have that very high-level being there with you, you're fine. And they try to get the attention of these people. If they can get their attention, they can improve their situation, you know, get them to a place where there's a little light and get them to feel a little better, and then start to talk about what it was. It really wasn't so bad. Mm. There's a story about some of the worst people who are going through the worst torments in the outer darkness level are the ones who made the Holocaust happen. This is just a story. I don't know if it's true, but my understanding is the people doing the rescue work there are their victims, trying to get their attention, saying, "We forgive you. Everybody forgives you. You did nothing wrong. None of it was real." Mm. So stop hitting yourself over the head with a hammer or whatever it is they're doing.
Someone said to me once in this regard that every person, regardless of which part they played, were doing just that. They were all playing a part. And you can name whatever calamity that you want, be it the Holocaust, 9/11, World War II, Civil War, etc., on and on, infinitum. And so when you start looking at it from that perspective, that they were doing nothing more than playing their part that they chose, so there is no blame or guilt. It would be no different than if there were a bunch of actors on stage playing out a scene, or like the Civil War reenactment people.
Yes.
They're just playing a role. That then maybe you might be able to view the incident from a different perspective. What about forgiveness? Is it necessary in that realm, whether it be of darkness or level two or three, is it necessary to forgive others? Is that at all important? Well, they did this thing to me, and I need to forgive them for doing this to me. Or is there that understanding of they were playing a role? There is no forgiveness needed because they were just playing their part.
One of the things that happens soon after we die is we have a party, and it's very, very a unique kind of party just for us. But people we knew during life show up, and some of the dead express amazement that the people that they most love in this eternal place were villains in their most recent lifetime. That horrible, you know, ex-wife or that boss that you hated, they were people we love, and they love us, and they were playing a role to help us grow spiritually. So yeah, we deeply understand that it was not real. I have never seen a case, and again, this is something I've looked for, never seen a case reported where people did not forgive others. It seems to be 100%, no matter what they did. Mm-hmm. You know, they burned the house down with their children inside. Horrible things, they forgive immediately. But what people have trouble doing is forgiving themselves specifically for not carrying out whatever they had planned as in terms of a growth lesson. That seems to be very hard for us to do. Mm-hmm. So I tell people, learn to forgive automatically. Everybody, no matter what they did, learn to forgive them, because that's flexing your forgiveness muscle. So when you have to forgive yourself, it'll be easier.
I have one more topic I want to touch on real quickly here before we wrap up the program. And I want to thank you so much for taking so much time with us here on Tell Me Your Story. Roberta Grimes is my guest, and we are talking about a couple of the books that, and I will tell you right now, Roberta, we will have you back. No worries about that.
I'm looking forward to it. Thank you.
The Fun of Dying, Find Out What Really Happens Next, and then The Fun of Staying in Touch, How Our Loved Ones Contact Us, and How We Can Contact Them. There's a passage in the Bible, since we've been referring to that particular book in particular, as well as yours, that I remember, and this goes back to your investigative process. I interviewed this gentleman who wrote this book called The Apocalypse Conspiracy. And in it, he went through this one passage that I'd like for us to talk a little bit about, and it's referred to as the rapture passage in the New Testament. And they'll all be caught up to meet him in the air. Now, the basic premise of this is that what he was doing is researching the correct translations and what these meant. And what he did was he researched the word air. Now, I did the same thing because I didn't want to say, oh, so-and-so said this in his book. I wanted to look it up for myself, and I found it. And so I pulled out my concordance, and I pulled out my Bible, and I looked up the word air in that passage. And there were two definitions that were listed. One of them was the birds fly through the air, the clouds, and on and on and on. But that was the second one that was so profound, it had to do with God breathed the breath of life into the nostrils of Adam. And it was that definition that was referred to in that passage in the New Testament, referred to as the rapture passage, which told him that all of this was an internal process. So when it comes to the saints, if you will, those who have gone after us, they are waiting there for us, or are they? They're about doing their individual work for the big picture, if you will, the grand design, right? They're not sitting around waiting for us to show up.
There is no throne. There is no royalty. Everybody there is working on his or her own spiritual development with the understanding we all have to get there. So we're working on helping other people grow spiritually as much as ourselves. Mm-hmm. People who are perhaps more devoted to that, I would consider saintly, but we're all saints. Mm-hmm. And people who still think the rapture will happen should know the whole idea of the rapture really is 19th century. It came from it came specifically from the dream of a 14-year-old girl, I think she was 14, mm-hmm. whose preacher caught it up and started preaching it, and pretty soon everybody's got it. The whole idea of Left Behind, that whole series of books, I call it religious pornography. It's pornography. And I don't think any of us should... I mean, we're all meant to learn the truth. Mm-hmm. Jesus said, if you hold to my teaching, you are really my disciples. Then you will know the truth, and the truth will set you free.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the gospel truth. Pardon me for saying it. I found that I had a much better relationship with my wayshower and best friend Jesus after I stopped being Christian. Then I couldn't hold both his truths and what I was learning as a Catholic.
Yeah.
I couldn't hold them in my mind at the same time. It was not possible.
Well, I always found it a little disconcerting and illogical that here was this man that is spoken of in the Bible who was born a Jew and supposedly founded the Christian religion. But never in the New Testament does it say that you should leave one belief system for another. It was just a transition. And I thought, well, then maybe I should be a Jew, because if he's the one I'm going to follow, then I should follow him. And he was a Jew. So I should be a Jew, right? I should convert.
No.
Well,
no.
I'm just saying in that context of what I was being taught, it just didn't make sense. Plus the fact that the word Christian was a derogatory comment made by the Romans in that day to criticize them. It was like saying, F you. You know, that was basically where they came up with that, and yet it was taken on as the name of that belief system. Let me before we wrap this thing up, I have three questions that I want to ask you, and the first one is, who is Roberta Grimes?
Oh, my goodness. I'm just a seeker like everyone else. I had an extraordinary experience when I was a child and then again at 20. So I knew that there was something to be researched. And I just researched it. I'm driven to do this work. And now that I know these truths, now that I've figured it out, and there are others, too. And when we meet, we complete each other's sentences. I just feel driven now to help everybody know this, at least expose people to the possibility that things could be as wonderful as they actually are. But in my day job, I'm still a business attorney. I probably will never retire from that. I love my clients, and I've never been to court, so I'm not that kind of lawyer. I'm a wife of 42 years, a mother of three, a grandmother of five, and my family is very important in my life, so I'm a regular guy like everybody else, just trying to do the best I can.
Well, now, this next question you've probably answered throughout the interview. I'll ask this just the same. What is it that you hope to or want to achieve through the work that you're doing now?
Clearly, I'm supposed to be doing something, and I just want to do that. This all began, I pray in gratitude affirmations, and I began in the summer, spring actually of 2009. To pray, thank you for giving me work to do. Thank you for showing me how to do it. That basically says, I give my life to you, God. It's up to you. Whatever you want me to do, I'll do. Within a month, I was writing down what I had been learning my whole life, and I was writing The Fun of Dying. God chose the publisher, and I won't, that's too long a story to tell you how. And it turned out I've got five dead clergymen working with me, none of whom I can perceive. And it took a medium, a friend of mine, to say, these guys are around you. They're working with you. And one of them's famous. And I said, why would he work with me? And she said, he wants to set the record straight. They all do.
Mm-hmm.
I've come to understand that's why there's so much about Jesus in what I do. They all taught this nonsense that God can't forgive us unless he gets to enjoy watching the murder of Jesus. They all taught that, and they know that's nonsense. It just didn't happen. And I mean, Jesus, there's no evidence in my heavy looking for it or anybody else's heavy looking for it that Jesus has ever redeemed anybody or needed to. That just isn't why he came. He had a much more important reason to come.
Mm. Finally, who inspires you?
Who inspires me? Jesus inspires me. Who living inspires me? There are some people. Craig Hogan is the author of Your Eternal Self, which everyone should read. And he's the one who told me I should write The Fun of Dying. He was he's the person on earth who is working, I think, with my guides. I think the Zammits are wonderful. They're in Australia. Everyone should go to Victor Zammit, ZAMMIT.com, and get their weekly newsletter. He's been doing this work for 25 years. He's a lawyer, too. And he's in your face with it. I admire that. I was a coward until basically I gave my life to God. God made me do this. But he's been doing it for 20 years. And he has a million-dollar challenge. If you can come up with a way that this is not true, I'll get, he calls them closed-minded skeptics. Really, they're just debunker fools. They have a belief system that just like closed-minded skeptics who think they're scientists, but they're not, because they're just trying to debunk the evidence of the afterlife and what it tells us. They're exactly the same as fundamentalist Christians. They got a belief system, and they don't care. He's had people tell him, you can prove it to me, and I still won't believe it. Now, if someone calls himself a scientist and says that, he's no longer a scientist, is he?
Yeah.
So I would say the Zammits, too, really inspire me. I'm not sure who else. We're all on a voyage. As Jesus said, the last will be first and the first last.
Mm-hmm.
We have to stay humble about whatever we're doing, because I don't want to be the first or the last. I'm trying to stay kind of in the middle.
Somewhere in the middle, yeah.
Can I talk about my coming to the West Coast? Because some of your listeners may be able to come and meet me, and I would love to meet them.
That would be great. Go ahead, and real quickly here before we wrap up. Go ahead.
I'm going to be in the end of October. I'm going to be in Mountain View and in the Bay Area. I'm going to be at the East West Bookstore in Mountain View, California on the 23rd, I think it is. Yes, mm-hmm. The 23rd of October, doing a workshop, and the 25th. So I'll be there twice. And it's all part of the same workshop. This takes a lot of time to talk about, especially since I give a lot of time for people to ask questions. I've been there. This is my third time at that bookstore, and I just love those people. And we had a great time both of the other times. On that Friday, the 24th of October, I'm going to be at South Bay Ians, I-A-N-D-S. And if you Google that, you can get directions to it. And this will also be my third time with the South Bay Ians group. And I love them. So I'm anxious. I'm looking. It's like old Hobie coming for me at the end of October in my wonderful, wonderful California.
Wonderful. Well, I will also extend an invitation to you that if you find yourself in the area of Santa Barbara, we'd love to have you in studio for an interview.
Oh, I would love that.
Yeah.
I don't know. It's kind of a big state, though, right? It's like Texas. It's kind of
well,
big.
Well, yeah, but we're on the coast. We're Central Coast, just north of Los Angeles, and a beautiful place to come to visit. Not a bad place to live either. But we encourage you, if you happen to find yourself here, we'd love to do an in-studio interview with you.
I would love that, Richard.
I want to thank you again for sharing so much time with us here on the program and your concepts. And I am in full agreement with you that we need to get to a place where we know these truths, not just believe them, because believing, that's one of the things that I learned. It took me a while, Roberta, but I finally learned never to debate or argue over belief, because you'll never win.
No, yeah. You can't.
And
right.
And so if somebody's coming from belief and you're coming from truth and you have evidence to back it up, that's going to be a tough row to hoe as well. But at least you can place it before them and let them decide. And that's what we do with this program. We lay out a smorgasbord and you come, you take what you need, leave the rest, and then check it out for yourself. You know, I'm not espousing any specific belief system here or construct. I'm not necessarily in total support of everything that every single one of my guests is talking about. What I am in total support of is you're having the opportunity to share that with our listeners, and I thank you for doing that today.
Thank you so much. RobertaGrimes.com, and please read my blog, and I'd love to hear what you think of it.
RobertaGrimes.com is her website. We encourage you to go there.
Yes.
We will link to her as well. I'm Richard Dugan. This has been Tell Me Your Story, New Paradigms for a New World. We're giving you choices and knowledge of those choices to help make your dreams come true. And until next time, love to Lal.